Hachette Audio presents The President's Daughter, written by Bill Clinton and James Patterson, read by David B. Fajr Al-Kaisi, James Chen, Jeremy Davidson, Amanda Dolan, Peter Ganem, Dion Graham, January Lavoy, Mary Stuart Masterson, and Sunila Nankani. Part 1.
Chapter 1. 2 a.m. local time, Gulf of Sidra, off the coast of Libya. Aboard a Night Stalker's Special Operations MH-60M Black Hawk helicopter, codenamed Spear 1, Navy Chief Nick Zeppos of SEAL Team 6 checks his watch. 5 minutes ago, he and his crew departed from the USS Wasp amphibious assault ship, outbound to their high-value target, this deep, dark night. If he and his crew, along with other SEAL fighters aboard a second Black Hawk helicopter, codenamed Spear 2, are fortunate, they will track down and kill Asim al-Ashid well before the sun rises. Zeppos spares a quick glance at his team members, packed in tightly around him in two crowded rows. In the loud, vibrating helicopter's interior, they're mostly silent, some sipping from plastic water bottles, others leaning over, hands tightly clasped. Up forward, the Night Stalker's pilot and co-pilot from the famed 160th Special Operations Aviation Regiment Airborne are flying at low altitude, about 10 meters above the choppy water, instruments glowing green and blue. Zeppos knows that every SEAL team member inside the dimly lit helicopter is going over the upcoming mission, thinking about their training, then clearing their minds for what's ahead. Killing Asim al-Ashid. It's been a long-range goal of the American intelligence agencies and military. Tonight, after 4 years of preparation, Zeppos hopes they will hit the jackpot. SEAL teams and special forces have gone after terrorist leaders before, notably Osama bin Laden and Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, and their many deputies and allies, leaders who stayed in the shadows, issuing the orders, not getting their hands soiled before making grainy videotapes and flowery promises of death and revenge.
"We're coming up on feet dry,"
comes the call from the Night Stalker's crew chief, indicating that they're about to cross over from the sea to the land of Libya, one fractured and squabbling nation, a perfect place to incubate or shelter terrorists like al-Ashid. But al-Ashid is not like other leaders of terrorist organizations. For the past several years, videos have appeared documenting his group's actions, each showing al-Ashid in the center of the bloody chaos, depending on a well-planned and well-hidden network of supporters who would only appear to assist him at the last moment and then disappear. Asim in a crowded shopping mall in Belgium, holding up a trigger device and calmly pressing the button, the hollow boom echoing through the concourse, causing the camera to shake, but not enough to hide the billowing cloud of smoke, the screaming shoppers running by, blood trickling down their torn faces and fractured arms. Asim walking down a street in Paris, cameraman following him as he unlimbers an automatic rifle from under a long raincoat, shooting into crowds of pedestrians, aiming especially for the women and children, until a white van picks him up and drives him safely away. Asim standing behind two sobbing female aid workers from the United Nations in the Sudanese desert, their legs and arms bound, as he calmly goes from one to the other, wielding a large sword and beheading both of them, their blood spattering his clothes. Navy Chief Zeppos stretches his legs, draws them back. Twice before he's been on raids, once into Yemen and once into Iraq, where the intel indicated a good probability that Asim was there, but good wasn't good enough. Both raids had come up empty, with no results except for wounded SEALs, shot up helicopters, and frustration all around. But Zeppos hopes that the third time will be the charm. There are other video recordings too gruesome to be released to the public. A woman schoolteacher in Afghanistan, chained to a rock, doused with gasoline, and set afire. A village elder in Nigeria, held tight by men from Boko Haram, as a seam goes down a line of his family members, slitting their throats. And Boyd Tanner. Zeppos spares a glance through the near porthole. He wants not to think of Boyd Tanner, whose cause of death is a closely kept secret among the Special Forces community, and sees the bright glow of light on the horizon marking the rapidly rebuilding port city and capital of Tripoli. The Chinese, in their program called the Belt and Road Initiative, have been pouring in development investments here and in other poor countries around the world. Publicly, the Chinese government says it's just a way for them, as a growing world power, to share their good fortune and knowledge. Privately, Zeppos and others have received classified briefings depicting the Chinese's real goal: securing resources, allies, and possible future military bases so China can never again be isolated and humiliated as it so often has been in its long history. The glow on the horizon fades away. Spear 1 and Spear 2 are now over the rolling Libyan deserts where decades back the Germans and British desperately fought, and where their rusted-out tanks and trucks still remain in the unforgiving sands. Before them, the Italians were once here, and now the Chinese, Zeppos thinks. Big deal. He starts to recheck his gear. The crew boss comes back on the intercom.
Chief, we've got incoming traffic for you, he says.
Zeppos toggles his mic.
Who, JSOC?
No, Nick,
the aviator says.
Definitely not JSOC.
Shit, he thinks. Who would dare bother him now?
Patch it through, he says.
And there's a crickle crackle of static. And a very familiar voice comes through, one he's heard scores of times over the radio and TV.
Chief Zeppos,
the man's voice says.
Matt Keating here. Sorry to bother you, I know you're busy. You don't need me to waste precious seconds, but I wanted to let you know that there's nothing I'd want more than to be riding with you right now.
Ah, thank you, sir,
he says, raising his voice so the president can hear him. Keating says,
I have full faith in you and your team that you'll get the job done. No worries on this end. I've got your back. Now you squids body bag that son of a bitch for the country, the SEALs, and especially for Boyd Tanner. Keating out.
Yes, sir, Zeppos says, part of him in awe that the man would call him personally, part of him touched by his sincere words. And yet, he hates to admit to himself, Zeppos is pissed off that he'd call right now, in the middle of an op. Shit, he thinks. Politics sure can screw up a man. Then he cuts the president some slack. Keating had been one of them, and he knew about Boyd Tanner. From SEAL Team 2. Only a few were supposed to know how he died, and it was not, as his grieving wife and kids were told, in a training accident. Captured last year after a brutal firefight in Afghanistan, wounded and barely alive, Asim al-Ashid and his fighters had stripped Boyd Tanner of his gear, his clothes, and taken him to a courtyard, recording it all the while. Whereupon Asim, using a hammer and spikes, had crucified the Navy warrior on a gnarled tree. The video captured the agonizing hour that Tanner hung there before the captors grew bored and slit his throat. A couple of guys down the length of the Black Hawk are laughing. Zeppos leans over, sees one of his crew, Kowalski, holding up what looks like a wooden spear with a metal tip. Zeppos calls out,
"What the hell is that thing for?"
Kowalski laughs and flourishes the spear.
"Asim al-Ashid," he yells out. "Once we ID his remains, we should take his head off, put it on this pike, and bring it back to the Oval Office. Don't you think the president will love that?"
More laughter, and Zeppos settles back into the uncomfortable seat, grinning. Yeah, it's a good night for him and his fellow warriors to avenge the deaths of so many innocents, and to finally come face to face with Asim al-Ashid, give him a few seconds to recognize who's before him, and then put two taps in his chest and one in his forehead. This darkened Black Hawk helicopter and its shadowy companion speed into the night.
Chapter 2. 2:15 a.m., local time. Embassy of the People's Republic of China, Tripoli. It's damn well late at night, or early in the morning. In the ground floor reception room for the Chinese embassy on Monastery Street and Gargarish Road, and Jiang Lijun, who's listed on the embassy guest list as a vice president for the China State Construction Engineering Corporation, is stifling a yawn. This supposed party was to have ended more than an hour ago, but the special guests from this blasted country still won't leave. The political leaders, the tribesmen, and the military officers, gaudy in their uniforms, stripes, and medals, like little boys playing dress-up, are still smoking, drinking, and talking to their patient hosts in various corners of the room. Jiang sees that the local representatives from the Great Wall Drilling Company, CNPC Services and Engineering, China National Petroleum Corporation, and so many others are valiantly standing in for Zhongguo, the middle country, by smiling, laughing at the stupid attempts at humor, and otherwise entertaining their peasant guests. And what barbarians. Even after the lights were dimmed, the near-empty food platters were taken away, and the liquor and bottles of beer, Carlsberg, Heineken, Tsingtao, were removed. These peasants didn't get the message that it was time to wander back to their flea-infested hovels. No, they stayed and gossiped, and some even pulled flasks of liquor from their coat pockets, even here, in this supposedly Muslim country. When he was an exchange student at UCLA in California, and then at Columbia in New York, a young Jiang thought he would never encounter a more childish, reckless, and ignorant group of uncouth people. But these Libyans make the Americans seem like honorary Han. He takes out a pack of Zhonghua cigarettes and lights one. He's standing by himself near two large potted plants, seeing who is talking to whom, which members of the embassy staff look drunk or impatient, and observing the groupings of Libyan guests. A very fragile ceasefire and reconciliation government arose last year, but Jiang still wants to see which tribe members stay away from their alleged fellow countrymen, perhaps setting the stage for a future breakup or civil war. Good information to have ahead of time. A slim, bespectacled embassy worker wearing an ill-fitting black suit comes in from the far side of the banquet room. He scans the crowd as he hurries across the polished floor. Ling, that's the boy's name. Jiang takes one last puff of the cigarette, stubs it out in the dirt of the nearest potted plant, and waits. The worker comes to him, bows slightly, and says, "My apologies, sir. Your presence is requested in the basement, room 12. Jiang nods, starts walking across the room, whereupon a heavy-set bearded man, swaying drunk and wearing typical tribal garb of billowing white blouse and black slacks, abruptly steps in front of him. "Mr. Jiang," he calls out in accented English, grasping Jiang's shoulders. And Jiang keeps a wide smile frozen on his face, trying not to choke from breathing in the alcoholic fumes coming from this dirty peasant.
"Are you leaving? Are you?"
Jiang pats the man's worn hands, gently tugs them off his shoulders. "I'm sorry, my friend, but you know how it is," he replies, also in English, the lingua franca of diplomacy in so many parts of the world. "Duty calls." The man, Jiang can't recall his name, only knows he's the leader of one of the 150 or so tribes in this barren land, sways again, belches, and says,
"Duty, yes."
Tears come to his eyes.
"I must say this. I must. But your duty, your presence here, it has brought so much to our land. The Italians, the French, the British, the Qataris, the damn Egyptians. They have all tried to rule us, take our resources. Who would think the yellow race would travel halfway around the world to shower us with your wisdom and knowledge?"
At this very moment, Jiang wants to slap the man hard in the face, spin him around, twist and break his neck. Yellow race indeed. And drop him on the floor. Instead, mindful of who he is and what he must do, Jiang keeps smiling, squeezes the man's filthy hands and says,
"When next I return to Beijing, I will make sure that your words of thanks are passed along to our president."
And with that, Jiang briskly walks away, feeling the need to go to a washroom and scrub that peasant's stench and dirt off his hands. But instead, he presses on. Duty. He walks past two unsmiling embassy guards with partially hidden earpieces and pistols barely covered by their suits, and he meets up with Ling, standing by the entrance to the lift. Ling is holding the door open for him, and Jiang ignores him, taking the stairs to the basement, moving fast. The electricity in this alleged country still has its sudden blackouts, and even with the building's backup generators, Jiang isn't going to risk being stuck between floors. He opens the door to the basement, going past another embassy guard, going down an ill-lit hallway until he comes to a heavy steel door equipped with a palm print reader mechanism. Jiang presses his right hand down. There's a brief flare of light, and the steel door swings open. Jiang steps inside, the door swinging shut and locking behind him. The room is pleasantly cool and comfortable, and he's now craving a smoke. But there's no smoking allowed in here, in the Embassy Operations Center for China's Ministry of State Security, staffed around the clock. The night duty officer, Liu Xiaobo, wearing black-rimmed glasses, casually dressed in black pants and white open-collared dress shirt, is typing on a keyboard in front of a large computer monitor.
"How goes that party upstairs?" he asks. "Lots of camel dung on the floor?"
"Not yet," Jiang says.
"What's going on?"
The small room is jammed with filing cabinets, counters, computer monitors, television screens showing CNN, the BBC, and CCTV 13, the China Central Television News Channel, as well as plasma screens depicting North Africa, the Mediterranean, and the Gulf of Sidra. Eight other members of the Ministry of State Security are also at work this early morning.
Liu says, "The Americans are up to something."
"Aren't they always?"
"Those dog whelps. What is it this time?"
"They have an amphibious assault ship in the Gulf of Sidra, about 20 kilometers off the Tripoli coast,"
Liu says, pointing to a reference map on his large video screen.
30 minutes ago, they launched two UH-60 helicopters, Blackhawks. They're heading in this direction."
A nicotine-stained finger traces a path on the glowing screen.
"And they violated Libyan airspace and are now about here."
Jiang stares at the screen, at the little triangles marking towns and villages. The geography so flat and nearly featureless until...
"They are heading to the Nafusa Mountains," Jiang says.
"Yes," Liu replies. "They appear to be flying straight and level, no evasive maneuvers. And based on the fuel consumption of their helicopters, there is barely enough fuel to get there and return back to the WASP. To me, that says they are going after something very important in those peaks, something worth the risk of running out of fuel."
"A stinging bee," Jiang thinks. "What kind of fools name a warship after an insect?"
He focuses again on the video display. Liu cautiously says,
"Don't you have an interest in the Nafusa Mountains?"
From long practice and years of work, Jiang keeps his face impassive, his breathing regular, his body still. One does not succeed or get promoted by showing emotion.
"Anything else?" he asks.
"No,"
Liu says.
"I just wanted you to know."
Jiang gently clasps the man's shoulder.
"That is appreciated, comrade."
Liu appears to enjoy the attention from a man higher up than he is.
"May I do any other service for you?"
Jiang nods.
"Yes. You have a worker here named Ling, correct? The one who came to fetch me?"
Liu's voice is cautious.
"Yes." "Get him on the next transport home," Jiang says.
Ensure he ends up working for the largest pig farm in Liaoning. Earlier when he came to me, he nearly ran across the room, practically shouting at me, telling anyone with a brain larger than a pea that I was someone of importance, and not just a typical technocrat. He needs to be punished. Very well, Liu says. Good, Jiang says. Now it's time to return upstairs to see if the camels have arrived, and if the peasants up there are tossing lumps of dung at each other. Liu laughs at that, returns to his large screen. Jiang walks away and uses a hand scanner to depart the operations center, going back into the empty hallway. If he were to turn left, he would go back to the upward staircase to the reception. Instead, he turns right, walking quickly to his office at the other end, where Jiang Lijun is not a vice president for the China State Construction Engineering Corporation, but a senior officer with the Ministry of State Security. What the hell are the Americans up to?
Chapter 3. 2:30 a.m., local time. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Aboard Spear 1, the crew chief calls out,
2 minutes! 2 minutes to target!
Nick Zeppos holds up 2 fingers in acknowledgement, and the other team members each hold up 2 fingers in response. They take off the helicopter's comm gear, put on their helmets with NVGs, which they quickly lower. Zeppos switches on the goggles, and the interior of the modified and stealth Black Hawk comes into sharp, ghostly green view. 2 minutes. 120 seconds. The voice of Spear One's pilot comes to Zeppos.
Target inside at about 2 o'clock.
Zeppos quickly recalls one other horrific murder that Asim al-Ashid committed 2 years ago, when in front of his followers, he and his group executed a Syrian family they thought had betrayed him, and they broadcast a video of the killing to the world. A simple execution. The family had been herded into a steel cage, doused with gasoline, and Asim had struck the match. The last clear image on the videotape, before the billowing smoke obscured the lens, was the crumpled form of the mother among the flames, desperately and futilely, covering her dying son's body with her own.
30 seconds, the pilot announces.
The helicopter's crew chief unlatches the side door, slides it open. Zeppos gives his gear one last check. Cold air rushes in. Zeppos stands up and calls out.
Stick close. Move fast. Let's get this done.
Nods of acknowledgement and thumbs up from his team members, all looking like the proverbial bug-eyed monsters with gear, weapons, and helmets with the four-lensed NVGs. Zeppos leans out the open doorway, takes in the buildings quickly coming into view. 3 small buildings to the left, 1 larger building to the right, set back by itself. That's Asim al-Ashid's home, where he is at this very moment, based on all the streams of intelligence gathering that came together to send Zeppos and his team out here tonight. The structures are all 1 story, built of rock and stone, a goat corral in the distance. And that's it. Not even enough buildings to make it a village. The Black Hawk helicopter flares out, hovers less than 1 meter above the rocky ground, and in seconds, Zeppos is first off, his Oakley combat boots touching ground in the western mountains of Libya, near the border with Tunisia. He's carrying about 50 pounds of gear, along with his Heckler & Koch 416 with extended magazines. But whenever an op like this kicks off, Zeppos feels light and trim. Through his night vision goggles, he sees the shapes of the other SEAL members, dropped off by Spear 2, as they move forward in the well-practiced bounding overwatch attack, with sections staying behind, providing cover to those in the lead, and then leapfrogging ahead to take point. Nick takes the lead, head moving back and forth, sending thin lines of the infrared laser sights moving around in the cold and dark air through his NVGs. Still quiet, he moves up the slope to the little compound, looking, evaluating, scanning. Nobody's made contact yet? No emerging target on the roofs of the 3 small buildings? Too damn quiet. His team is spread out in their roles, weapons at the ready, heads moving back and forth. Their advance should have encountered resistance by now. Breach team, Nick whispers to the men next to him. Go. With his NVGs, he sees the infrared laser designators flickering around as he keeps on moving. The breach team moves around the larger building, goes to a side window. Chances are the main door is booby-trapped. He feels a slight thump through the soles of his boots, a brief flare of light. Movement of his team into the building. He and the others keep up their silent movement. Through the earpiece to his PRC-148 embitter radio, he hears one of his team, Ramirez.
Nick.
Go.
We're in the target house.
Yeah?
It's empty, says the disappointed voice. Nobody's here.
Chapter 4. 7:30 p.m. local time, White House Situation Room. It's crowded in the Situation Room this tense evening. I'm at the head of the table, watching the raid on Asim al-Rashid's compound unfold. It's tight quarters, with Vice President Pamela Barnes sitting in the near corner, staring at the video screens, and with Admiral Horace McCoy, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, sitting at my elbow. Next to him are a Navy captain and an Army colonel, tapping away on their secure government laptops, whispering information for McCoy to pass on to the crowd in this historic room. Funny thing that doesn't get reported much is that there's more than just one room in here. The others, full of staff serving and processing information from around the world. Besides the vice president, the other officials in here are Jack Lyon, my chief of staff, the members of my national security team, and a White House photographer. The two most important are a stern black woman with long braided hair, Sandra Powell, the national security advisor, and Pridham Kolam, Secretary of Defense, a smooth-faced, bespectacled man who looks younger than his 40 years. Sandra is both a defense and foreign policy expert and the author of several policy books that are actually easy to read. Pridham was appointed because of his mastery of the Pentagon's massive, complex budget and his extraordinary ability to cut through the regulatory and procurement jungle to get needed weapon systems off the design software and into the field. He also has important defense experience from his previous job as a Deputy Assistant Secretary for International Security Policy. Though the media refers to them as President Keating's security team, they're largely my predecessor's team. I just haven't had the time to evaluate them and decide who I want to stay on as my term ends its first full year, which began 6 months ago when my predecessor, President Martin Lovering, died of an aortic aneurysm that ruptured while he was fishing on the Columbia River in his beloved Washington state. Admiral McCoy says Spear 1 and Spear 2 are 30 seconds out from the target. I nod, looking up at the ghostly infrared images displayed on the large center screen, showing the two modified stealth Black Hawk helicopters approaching the small compound where Asim al-Rashid and his band of followers are supposed to be hiding. One of those helicopters is carrying Navy Chief Nick Zeppos. I guess I shouldn't have called him a few minutes ago, but the temptation was too great. I really did want to wish him well, and I really wished I could have been on this raid, where the objectives are clear and one's enemies are out in the open, unlike in the Washington political scene, where motives are murky and adversaries disguise themselves within power suits and smooth rhetoric. My right hip aches in muscle memory at seeing the SEALs fly in, remembering my own missions and that helo crack-up years ago in Afghanistan that shattered my hip and ended my Navy career. Later, at loose ends, I opted for a fresh round of danger and peril. I entered politics, and the good people of Texas's 7th Congressional District sent me to represent them on Capitol Hill. The helicopters halt in their flight, and ghostly figures emerge from both, advancing in the bounding overwatch attack I'm so very familiar with. A faint snap, and I realize I've just broken the pen I'm holding. No one seems to notice except my vice president, who gives me a cool, appraising glance, and then goes back to watching the screen. They say politics is the art of the compromise, and the last tumultuous year has been full of it. When then-Senator Martin Lovering was on the edge of getting enough delegates to win our party's nomination 2 years ago, there was a push to balance the ticket and enhance his national security creds by picking me, someone who hadn't been in Congress very long and certainly hadn't been in what's known as the race for the White House. That calculated political move angered a lot of the party's more dovish members, including Florida Governor Pamela Barnes, who had run a close second to Senator Lovering in the campaign, and who understandably thought that she should have been asked to serve as vice president with Lovering. Well, that dream did eventually come true for her. A month after I became president, because of President Lovering's sudden and unexpected death, I nominated her to the job. She was the third person to become vice president in this way, since the 25th Amendment gave us a process to fill a vacancy in that office. I chose her because I wanted to unify our party, hoping that we could accomplish more as I served out the rest of my predecessor's term. But if Barnes was happy or grateful to get her current spot, she never once showed it to me. Meanwhile, flanked by my national security team, I'm doing something that's hard for me, keeping my damn mouth shut. Waiting. On the screen, I see the shapes of the SEALs moving briskly and efficiently, and I fight off my own memories of being on missions just like this one. With your team, breathing hard, weapon in hand, every sense in your body heightened, on the move, following the rehearsed plan, ready at a moment's notice to open fire. I've been there before, in Iraq, Afghanistan, Yemen. In all of them, the constant factor was being out at night exposed, with your best friends and fellow warriors around you, ready to cry havoc and let slip 5.56 millimeter ammunition and grenades at our nation's enemies. Like these men now in Libya, nearly 5,000 miles away, their every movement and action being noted here in this room. Being here instead of there feels strange. Adding to the unreality, just a short walk away from this intense meeting, is my wife, Dr. Samantha Rowell Keating, working on a paper for some prominent archaeological journal, and our daughter Melanie, whom we always call Mel, holding a party in the family quarters with some of her classmates from Sidwell Friends. I'm happy for both of them. It's not easy to maintain any sort of normal life in this very unnormal place. I'm looking at the screen again, seeing the figures move, see three enter a building. That's all. No flares of light, no tracer rounds, no frantic movement of armed men rushing out to attack the invaders. Admiral McCoy clears his throat. Sir, I know, I say. The raid's a bust. A Simala sheet isn't there.
Chapter 5. 2:35 a.m. local time. Embassy of the People's Republic of China, Tripoli. In his secure and dull basement office, marking his role as the senior officer of the Chinese Ministry of State Security for all of North Africa, Jiang Lijun sits at his desk, smoking another Zhonghua cigarette, thinking. The room is spare, with only one bookshelf and three heavy metal locked filing cabinets. A photo of the great helmsman is on the wall, next to one of the current president. On his desk are two photos, one of his wife, Zhen, and the other of his late father. Jiang was only 5 years old in 1999, when he and his weeping mother stood on the tarmac at the Beijing Capital International Airport, awaiting the cremated remains of father after the Americans killed him, along with two others in the basement of the Chinese embassy. The May 7 raid had occurred during the NATO bombing campaign to halt the Serbians from doing what was their destiny, to control their territories and conquer their enemies. The West had been using that tactic for centuries, but because the Serbs were the other, they were blamed and bombed for doing the same as all the great powers. Father had been working at the Chinese embassy on Augusta Cesarca Road as a communications officer when four bombs from an American B-2 Spirit hit the embassy, supposedly by mistake, although no one in China believed such a tale. Everyone knew it was a deliberate attempt by the West to punish China for standing with the Serbians. Later, as Jiang grew older and attended school, he learned that the bomber that killed Father had come from the famed American Air Force 509th Bomb Group, the same that had dropped the atomic bombs in 1945, incinerating tens of thousands of civilians. That unit, he thinks, has experience in killing innocent Asians. He gives a quick glance at the photo of Jun, taken during their honeymoon in Hawaii. Right now, she's in Beijing, visiting her ill father. She works at the ministry's headquarters at 14 Dongchan'an Avenue as a personnel manager. Jiang's grandfather, Jiang Yun, had been an illiterate peasant until he joined the Red Army, fighting both the Japanese and the Kuomintang, and then becoming a quiet yet powerful party functionary in Shanghai. He had lived long enough to see how successful his son had become, and Jiang feels a pang of regret that the Americans prevented his father from seeing his own son's success. Jiang touches Jun's photo for a moment. He has vowed many times that their future child will grow up in a peaceful and strong world, a global community recognizing the proper place and strength of China, whatever it takes. He opens the center drawer of his desk, takes out a detailed map of Libya, and goes to the cold, carpeted floor, where he spreads it out. There are hundreds of high-quality digital maps available for him here in the secure ministry computer system that can show an individual flower in the White House Rose Garden, or the upturned faces of American sailors on the bridge of a nuclear-armed ballistic missile submarine departing Kitsap in Washington State. But accessing such maps leaves digital traces for others in his ministry and elsewhere to see. He's skilled at not leaving any traces. A finger moves from the Gulf of Sidra to the mountains of Nafusa. Jiang looks at the legend at the base of the map, marking distances in kilometers. He goes to his desk, returns with a metal ruler, places it on the map. He wishes he knew the exact location of that American Navy ship, named, he still cannot believe, after a stinging insect. But asking that question would raise too many others later down the line. The night duty officer here, Liu Xiaobo, is correct. The Americans will be very shortly landing in these rugged mountains without much of a fuel reserve. Oh, they can get refueled mid-air. But in Libya, there are plenty of electronic eyes and ears from the Middle Country, Russia, Iran, and others. Curious eyes and ears that can cause a lot of questions to be raised. He rubs the little triangles of the marked villages. Liu is doubly correct. Jiang does have an interest in someone living there. And now he wonders what to do. He leaves the map and ruler on the floor, goes back to his desk. He removes a thin chain from around his neck that holds a small rectangular digital key and inserts it into the lower right-hand desk drawer. A faint click, and he opens the drawer. This device came directly to him from Schlage, avoiding the ministry's supply system, and he is certain that this drawer cannot ever be tampered with or opened without his permission. Among papers, thumb drives, notebooks, and other possessions is the latest limited-edition satellite phone, made by Iridium, an American company. And it's special in that it can be used inside a building. The West is finally beginning to learn that all those cheap electronics they purchased from the Middle Country over the decades contained spyware and electronic backdoors for his employers, and Jiang needs a secure way to make phone calls without being tracked by his own people. A small notebook comes out, with certain numbers written inside. He powers up the satellite phone, waiting a few seconds to calculate his next move. Kill Americans, he finally decides, as the phone blinks to life. What he has been destined to do ever since that May night in 1999.
Chapter 6. 2:40 a.m., local time, Nafusa Mountains, Libya. In the clear and cold mountain air, Nick Zeppos holds up his closed fist, signaling to everyone within eyeshot to keep quiet. Fury builds inside of him. Shit, not again. The third time isn't going to be the charm. He scans the small buildings, sees a stone-strewn path leading up to a rise. He stares at it, knowing that their rides home are out there, circling in the distance, waiting to take them back to the Wasp, hopefully carrying satchels full of intelligence info and a body bag holding the warm remains of Asim al-Ashid. But their hands are empty of such prizes, and Spear 1 and Spear 2 up there are going to be empty of fuel soon enough. Decision time. He's reaching for his mic, ready to send out the recall request, when he thinks he hears a bell. What? He starts up the path. The tinkling noise grows louder. He knows the fuel tanks of the two Black Hawk helicopters are getting emptier. But he keeps on moving.
Chapter 7. 7:40 p.m. local time, White House Situation Room. In the increasingly tense atmosphere of the Situation Room, Vice President Pamela Barnes speaks up for the first time. "Why aren't the SEALs leaving?" she demands. "Isn't the fuel running low for their transport? Wasn't their time on Libyan soil limited? And their presence illegal, I might add?" I want to respond, but I keep my mouth shut. Years ago, when I was a member of the teams, BUDS, Basic Underwater Demolition SEAL, Class 342, I could answer her question within seconds. But I'm no longer a SEAL. Just POTUS. Others will have to answer her inquiries. At my side, Admiral Horace McCoy, head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, says, "Madam Vice President, the situation still remains fluid. I imagine the SEAL teams are exploring and exploiting the situation to see if there are any possible targets within their vicinity." I say, "Any other questions, Pamela?" She glares at me, and I stare right back at her. She does a good job as vice president, did a fairly good job as governor of Florida, and nearly got to the Oval Office as a candidate 2 years ago. But she's reactive and doesn't know much when it comes to the military. My vice president thinks SEAL members and others are wind-up toys that, once dispatched, go in one direction, follow their orders, and quickly return. And if they get broken or destroyed along the way, well, so what? There are plenty more where they came from. "Sir," Admiral McCoy says, "look at the screen." I turn away from Vice President Barnes and look at the ghostly moving images coming in from our overhead drone assets. The white shapes of the SEAL fighters are stretched out in a skirmish line, and the drone follows their movements. Other buildings come into view, along with an enclosure with small animals milling about. Other ghostly white shapes begin to show up on the roofs of these new buildings, weapons in hands. Admiral McCoy says, "I think the situation is evolving, sir." I say, "Good."
Chapter 8. 2:40 a.m., local time, Nafusa Mountains, Libya. Once they approach the crest of the small rise, Chief Zeppo's attack force, acting as one, flattens out on the rocky soil and clumps of stunted grass and shrubbery so as not to be silhouetted against the night sky. Zeppo peers over, his HK-416 assault rifle firm in his gloved hands, the ground cold against his body. He whispers, "I'll be damned." Over to the left is a small stone corral with goats, some with bells around their necks. A louder tinkle-tinkle reaches him. But what really gets his attention is the layout of this compound. It's a mirror image of where they landed several long minutes ago. A mapping error. What a goddamn surprise. A whisper in his headphones from one of his team members, who uses the word for terrorists.
"This is Blake. 2 tangos inside a building to the southwest. Engaging."
"Roger that,"
Zeppos says, his whole mood and attitude changing, thinking, "Yes, here we go, we're at the right spot. Asim al-Rashid, we're coming for you." A muffled pift, pift, pift comes from the area of the smallest building to the left. 2 men carrying AK-47s crumple to the ground. Not a peaceful tribal compound now, is it? An element of surprise is gone, if it ever was really there. "Semper Gumby," he thinks. "Always flexible." He gets up from the rise, and the platoon quietly, quickly, and efficiently moves into action, moving as one combined unit, none of the yelling and shrieking of "go, go, go" you see in bad video games. Just a tightly knit group moving as they were trained, getting the job done with as little drama as possible. A man, also armed, runs out of the closest small building, and Zeppos takes him down with 2 shots. And as he moves quickly by the motionless form, he puts 2 more into the man's chest. Closer now to the larger building, and Zeppos thinks that with drones and other intelligence assets overhead, every move, whisper, and shot fired in this small compound is being witnessed by personnel at the Combined Special Operations Center in Bagram, in viewing rooms at the Pentagon and Langley, and in the White House Situation Room. He hates to admit it, but he feels just a bit of pride and pressure at knowing that the President of the United States is watching their progress tonight from thousands of miles away. After all, the former Vice President and Texas Congressman had once done this same work, having served in the teams years ago, just after the Twin Towers came down. "We won't let you down, sir," Zeppos thinks. "Reach, team," he whispers. "Go." Two of his SEALs peel off and approach the larger building. It's in view more clearly now, and Zeppos feels himself becoming cool and composed. In another minute or so, there'll be a dynamic entry, and any male person in there is going to get two taps to the chest and one to the forehead. Photos will be taken of the target corpse. The body will be measured and fingerprinted, and DNA swabs will be taken later for positive analysis. "Asim," he thinks, "we're coming for your ass." The two SEALs are at the door. Zeppos sees that the door is heavy metal, padlocked. It's going to take a bit longer if the windows are similarly secured. They move around to the side, seeking an opportunity. Another whisper from Miller, another team operator.
"Tango engaged."
Pift, pift. The SEALs are at a window at the larger building, their target, and they begin their work, and the light and sound of the explosion knocks Zeppos back, hard, on the ground. He coughs up blood and dirt and rolls, getting to his knees, HK-416 in his hands, blind. He blinks, flips up the night vision goggles, shades his eyes from the sudden light with his hands. The target building has collapsed from an explosion, flames and smoke billowing. Gunfire rattles out from the other two buildings. Zeppos flattens his position, starts returning fire.
"Status?" he says. "Status!"
No answer from his SEAL members. He fires twice more.
"Status!"
he calls again, louder.
"Status!"
Rounds come whining in and about him, striking nearby rocks. "Shit, shit, shit," he mutters, switching out an empty magazine with a full one for his assault rifle. "Sorry, sir," he thinks, firing again at the winking lights on the closest building. "We failed."
Chapter 9. 7:45 p.m. local time, White House Situation Room. 7:40 p.m. local time, White House Situation Room. Admiral McCoy says, "Contact. The SEALs are engaging armed men in the second compound. It looks like the other landing site was a mistake." I just nod. What else could I do? There's a thought in the back of my mind. Is this going to be a Carter moment or an Obama moment? Unlucky Jimmy Carter learning in April 1980 that the bold plan to rescue the Iranian-held hostages has ended in a flame-filled debacle in the desert. Or lucky Barack Obama learning in this very room that the bold plan to kill OBL in May 2011 has ended in triumph with the words from Abbottabad, "For God and country, Geronimo, 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 E-K-I-A." The corner of the large video screen briefly flashes with the image of the helicopters due in minutes to pick up the SEALs, hopefully uninjured, and carry out loads of computer hard drives, papers, thumb drives, cell phones, and a large flare of light appears in the upper right of the screen. Some people in the room murmur, and Vice President Barnes calls out, "What just happened?" I pick up another pen, hold on to it. All I can do. It's out of our hands. It's out of all of our hands. And like so many times before, a carefully planned military operation has failed upon contacting the enemy. The bad guys always get a vote, I recall from my Navy days. Admiral McCoy says something's gone wrong. "I can tell," I say. "The target building, we all saw it, it just exploded." Vice President Barnes says sharply, "Was it the SEALs?" "No, ma'am," the admiral says. "The explosion seems internal. It wasn't caused by our forces on the ground, nor by any of our air assets in the area." More whispers to him from the Navy captain and the Army colonel. I say, "Understood." Up on the screen, the collapsed building comes into better view. More ghost figures move around. One, and then two, fall. Our nation's finest, falling on foreign soil, wounded or killed, sent in by me. McCoy says, "The SEALs are returning fire, sir, and three have entered the destroyed building to examine to see what's going on. I just nod. The faces of the other people in the Situation Room seem drained of blood, of any thoughts. We're all just waiting. Waiting. I say, are the helicopters still safely on station to exfil? Whispers at my side. And the Admiral says, yes, sir. Do you? No, I interrupt. The guy's on the ground. It's their call. Yes, sir, he replies. I wait. The Vice President is staring at me, her face stern, her short blonde hair perfectly styled and in place. McCoy clears his throat. Sir, the SEALs are preparing their exfil. We have casualties, sir. How many? 2 KIA, at least 3 WIA. 2 dead and 3 wounded. Shit. And Asim al-Ashid, what's his status? No answer. I huddle once more. I drop the pen and slap my hand on the conference room table. Admiral, what's the status of Asim al-Ashid?
Chapter 10. 2:45 a.m. local time. Nafusa Mountains, Libya. His lower left shin is hurting, and Chief Zeppos glances down, sees the torn fabric of his fatigue pants, now feels blood trickling down. Fuck it, he thinks as he works with the other SEAL team members to get control of this screwed-up goat wrangling. The large building that exploded a few minutes ago is partially collapsed, smoke trails going up, small fires burning. They are still taking fire from the near ridge, but it's undisciplined and random. And Lopez, the best sniper in his platoon, is calmly taking the gunmen out, one by one, with his MK-13 Remington bolt-action rifle. Goats who were spooked to shit by the explosion are now milling around their stone corral, looking for some human caretaker. Long friggin' wait, goats, Zeppos thinks. One of his guys, Jerez, comes to him and says, "We got the wounded stabilized, Nick." He nods. The wounded just might make it, and the heavy cost of 2 dead just might be the only high price paid tonight. Prudhomme is dead. A good guy from New Orleans, who is the shittiest cook in the unit, despite his last name and Cajun heritage. And Kowalski, who wanted to see Malashid's head on a pike, a trophy to bring back to the Oval Office. 3 other men are coming out of the collapsed building, coughing and moving quickly in his direction. Picabo is at Zeppos' side. No military age, men. No computer drives, no filing cabinets, not a goddamn thing. Just bedding and stoves and canned food. There are 7 dead terrorist fighters in and around the compound, and an earlier quick examination showed that none of them was Asim al-Ashid. Zeppos spits on the ground, sees his 3 guys being treated, and sees Wallace standing guard over the still forms of Prudhomme and Kowalski. Anything else? Picabo coughs. Shit, Chief, sorry. We got dead civilians in there. Fuck, Zeppos says. The fire up on the ridge seems to have ceased. His wounded leg is still aching. The target building, with nothing inside worth this trip, or his wounded or dead, still smolders. Picabo says, shitheads knew we were coming. Yeah. Time for exfil, Chief? Zeppos toggles his radio mic. Yeah, he says. Time to get the hell out of here.
Chapter 11. 7:49 p.m. local time, White House Situation Room. On the display screen, I see the flames and smoke trails coming up from the large building that was the SEAL's target this disastrous evening. The shot of the compound widens some from the local viewing platform, allowing us to see the 2 specialized stealth MH-60M Black Hawk helicopters descend to pick up the team. I intently watch as the shadowy white figures make their way to the helicopters, some walking with assistance from their teammates. 2 sets of SEALs are moving slower, burdened by carrying their dead comrades between them. Sir, says Admiral McCoy. Go, I say. Asim al-Ashid wasn't there, he says. And I hear a few people in the room sigh with disappointment. 7 terrorists were killed. They were closely examined, and none matched his description. The room is quiet. All eyes on me. This crowded facility is now a very lonely place. Were they able to retrieve anything of value? No, sir, he says. A few jihadi pamphlets, identification cards from the dead terrorists, that's it. No computer drives, no thumb drives, no cell phones. I see the helicopters lift off from the compound. Soon the screen is clear except for the smoke and the death. Will the helicopters have enough fuel to get back to the Wasp, I ask? Not sure, Admiral McCoy says, but they'll get there safely. The Wasp can maneuver in closer to shore, or we can set up air refueling once they get their feet wet. I stare at the screen, where a few minutes ago there were hard, determined men fighting for a goal, for a country, for me, and now there's nothing. Admiral, I say. Sir. I glance at him, at the somber faces of my team. I'm sure they were all looking forward to seeing me announce on television that Asim al-Rashid was killed or captured, and I've no doubt that some would later have told friends and family what it was really like to be next to the President of the United States on such a momentous occasion. Civilians, I say. Were there any civilians killed? To his credit, McCoy doesn't hesitate. Yes, sir. A woman and three young girls. It seems from what documentation the SEALs recovered that they were the wife and three daughters of Asim al-Rashid. Oh, damn, I think. Killed by us, I say. Killed when the building exploded, McCoy says. And it exploded because we were there, I say. From crossfire striking an IED, somebody dropping an RPG round and cooking off a pile of munitions, something like that. The room is briefly silent. To no one in particular, I say, can someone kill that goddamn video feed? In about a second, the screen goes black. At least something has gone right tonight. I catch the attention of my chief of staff, Jack Lyon. He's heavy set with round horn-rimmed glasses, brown hair, slicked back. He's been a party pro for years and was my predecessor's first appointment. And I've kept him on because he knows how to open doors and make the right phone calls to the right people, which is worth more than gold in this city. Jack, I say. Sir, he says. I check the clocks. We're closing in on 8 p.m. Too soon. Contact the networks and cable news stations, I say. I'm going to make a public announcement at 9 p.m. The SEALs should be safely back at the Wasp by then. With a murmur of voices and heads turning to me, my chief of staff says, the major networks might be reluctant to cut into their programming unless I can give them information on what you plan to say, Mr. President. And have them leak it within 60 seconds of you calling? He says, at least a 5-minute warning. Give them that, Mr. President. I nod. Fair enough. Tell them that at 9 p.m. I plan to inform the world of tonight's military action against Asim al-Rashid, and explain that it did not meet its objectives. Don't say fail, I think. Americans don't like the word failure. National Security Advisor Sandra Powell says, Mr. President, I think you should pause. Wait until all the facts come in, and I lift my hand. No, I say. Not tonight. We screwed up. We killed civilians. That's not who we are. It was by accident and in the fog of war, but I'm not going to have this administration duck and weave and issue weasel-worded statements on how we're not going to say anything until all the facts are in. To hell with that. We all saw what happened. The SEALs went in under my orders and authority and performed their mission. It didn't go well, and in the process, innocents died. That's our responsibility. The room stays quiet. Secretary of Defense Pridham Kalam clears his throat. If I may, Mr. President. The troops in the field might not appreciate your remarks. At that moment, I snap. Pridham, who do you think knows more about how the troops feel? A veteran or a graduate of the Sloan School at MIT? I instantly regret the words. The Secretary of Defense's face reddens, and he looks down at his notepad and papers. I look around at my advisors. Keep it together. Tonight, I'll explain the goals of the mission and repeat the intelligence reports of the crimes Asim al-Rashid has committed over the years, I say. I'll say that I ordered in the SEALs based on the best information and intelligence we had, and I'll express my personal regrets as to what happened in that compound. Chief of Staff Lyon quietly asks, an apology, Mr. President? With the responsibility comes the apology, I say. It's the right thing to do. National Security Advisor Powell presses me. Mr. President, if I may, this will be a grave mistake. You'll be undermining our standing and our authority in that part of the world, our allies, while publicly praising us will secretly wonder if we're going weak. I gather up pens, papers, and legal pad and stand up. One of the perks of being president is that when you stand up, the meeting is over. If being weak is taking responsibility for your mistakes, I say, then I'm all right with that. A few more of my people try to say something as I go out the door, but Vice President Pamela Barnes, sitting in the corner and just looking at me, is not one of them.
Chapter 12. 9:06 p.m. local time. Vice President's residence, U.S. Naval Observatory. After a long, steaming hot shower in her private quarters at the U.S. Naval Observatory installation, Vice President Pamela Barnes is wearing a plain blue terry cloth bathrobe that has accompanied her from the governor's mansion in Tallahassee to here in Washington. As she tries to do most nights after wading through the swamp of D.C. politics, she's relaxing in a comfortable chair, a tumbler of Glenlivet and ice in hand, her husband, Richard, at her feet. He's leaning against a footstool, rubbing moisturizing lotion into her cracked and sore feet, which have been a constant irritant ever since she stood up for herself and others and entered politics years back. The luxurious living room, stuffed full of antique furniture and oil paintings, is dimly lit, and on the large screen television before them, the President of the United States seems to be wrapping up his announcement.
Through the offices of the International Red Cross in Geneva, I've directed the State Department to begin the process of offering financial compensation to the families of those accidentally killed tonight by our military.
The Vice President's husband snorts, his strong hands working in the lotion.
Fool. Might as well just hand that terrorist fella a blank check. Hasn't he figured out that whatever money goes to that man's relatives will slip through and go right to Asim al-Rashid?
Barnes takes a satisfying sip of the harsh whiskey, the one little vice she allows herself each night. One drink, and one drink only. She spent enough time in Tallahassee to see how many promising careers were wrecked over too much booze and too little judgment. She says, Treasury says they can work around that. Set up some sort of fund that can only be accessed by certain people. Traceable so it can't be used to buy plastic explosives or ammunition. Richard reapplies some of the moisturizer into his strong, weathered hands. He was a cattleman in Osceola County and made his living through that and by selling a chunk of his land for a casino years back. She met him when she was a Florida state senator and he was a representative, and she was initially attracted to his beefy frame. He was no pretty boy state rep in a nice suit, and sharp political mind. It was due to his strategizing that she had gotten to the governor's mansion in Tallahassee, and just a handful of goddamn delegates away from becoming president, a goal that had been so tantalizingly close to being realized. Damn that man, she thinks, taking another sip, recalling that unctuous and oily senator from Washington State who hadn't had the goddamn decency to croak before the convention was over and chose Matt Keating as his veep, leading her to take the nomination by acclamation. Now there were talks already about naming schools and highways after the dead damn fool who hadn't given her the job that was rightfully hers.
The actions tonight of the Naval and Army Forces of the United States were done under my orders, and they carried out my orders with their typical excellence and bravery,
Keating says.
If there is any blame associated with tonight's military action and the resulting civilian deaths, it is mine and mine alone. The Army and Navy performed admirably and did all that was asked of them.
Richard goes back to work on her feet, and damn it, she does so enjoy his strong hands at work down there.
Bullshit, he says. They screwed the pooch, and you wrapping yourself in a flag ain't gonna help you, Navy boy. The voters don't like fuck-ups, and they sure as hell don't like the United States apologizing, not to mention handing out money while they do.
Richard, please. He stops and looks up at her with his hard gray eyes, his thick brown hair trimmed and styled.
Pamela, you listen now and listen good, and please don't interrupt me.
another sip of her drink. All right, go on.
It's like this, he says. You and I both know that while Keating is doing okay in the polls right now, his support is soft, especially in the party. There's a lot of good people out there, people with long memories and deep pockets, who think you got screwed over at the convention in Denver. If Lovering had the balls to do the right thing and had picked you as Veep, then you'd be in the Oval Office, not that Texas cowboy. And you and I both know that you sure as hell wouldn't be on national television apologizing for anything.
The warmth of the whiskey is seeping through her, and her feet are feeling fine. And she says, Ancient history, Richard. All done and past. He wipes his hand on a small white towel, stands up.
History is what we make of it, Pamela. You know what's going to happen. He'll get a little bump in the polls by pretending to be a strong man, but in a while the stories and the gossip will come out about how weak he is, how he went on national TV tonight with two of our brave Navy SEALs dead, and how he pissed on their memory and bravery by apologizing like a little schoolboy. And you combine that with how he can't control his bitch wife Samantha, that snooty college professor. Well, in 6 months, his support will be cratering.
Over the years, Richard's homeboy style and rough way of talking have fooled many a slick and supposedly smart political opponent, and Pamela has learned to trust his instincts. And that'll be less than a year until the Iowa caucuses and the New Hampshire primary, she says. A pleased nod.
You got it, Pamela. Look, let me start poking around, talking to people. See what resources are out there. There are plenty in the party who are ready to drop Keating and back you up when the right time comes. It's our job to make sure there is a right time.
Pamela sees the man on the television screen say,
Thank you, and good night.
The vice president picks up the remote, switches off the television, finishes off her drink. Then do your job, Richard, she says.
Chapter 13. 4:05 a.m., local time. Embassy of the People's Republic of China, Tripoli. In a small dining room off the main kitchen at the Chinese embassy, Jiang Lijun of the Ministry of State Security and a handful of other night staff are watching the China Central Television News Channel service on a set suspended from a corner of the ceiling. On the screen, the American president is making a somber speech, explanatory subtitles scrolling. Sitting next to Jiang at a round dinner table, smoking a cigarette and sipping a cup of tea is Liu Xiaobo, the night duty officer who alerted him to the American attack. He's taking a morning break.
Unbelievable, is it not?
Liu asks. Jiang nods, sipping his own cup of Dao Hong Pao tea.
I certainly agree.
Liu shakes his head in wonderment.
Amazing. The fool is actually apologizing for what his soldiers did tonight. Apologize? Can you imagine our president apologizing for anything like that? He wouldn't dare. If he even attempted to do such a thing, the presidium would bring him up short in a moment, perhaps even demote him.
Jiang smiles, takes another satisfying swallow of the hot tea.
In 2 years, the American voters will have their chance to demote Keating, if they choose to. The night officer says,
True, and what a gift that would be, huh?
Agreed, Jiang says, reflecting on all that's gone on since the former president suddenly died. Ever since he assumed the office, Keating has been pushing us, pressing us, humiliating us. Complaints in the World Trade Organization, lawsuits over patents and copyrights, even running ships and planes over and near our bases in the South China Sea. Like those waters belonged to them and not us.
Up on the television screen, Jiang watches the humble yet arrogant American president mouth his words of apology. Jiang's table mate, Liu, is entirely correct. To see their own president on television, groveling and nearly weeping like this American leader, it would never happen. Never.
Which is why,
Jiang thinks.
We will eventually win.
No apologies. Just the actions of a world power gaining its rightful place. Liu taps cigarette ash in his teacup saucer.
Wouldn't it be something, Comrade Jiang, if, when the time comes for those Americans to vote, this failed raid tonight and his speech full of regrets would cause Keating's defeat? What a happy outcome that would be.
Jiang nods with satisfaction, recalling that single phone call he made less than 2 hours ago from his secure office in the basement. A call made for his nation, of course, but for his unborn child as well.
A very happy outcome, indeed, he says.